Greetings, urban farmers, gardeners, and healthy food visionaries. Farmer Greg here, and welcome to the 805th episode of the Urban Farm Podcast, where every day we work together to educate and inspire you to become part of your food revolution. Today on our podcast, we have someone who is empowering conversations about the power and politics of seeds. We're talking with Jennifer Jewell about What We Sow. Jennifer is the host of the national award-winning weekly public radio program and podcast Cultivating Place, conversations on natural history and the human impulse to garden. She is an author, and her third book is called What We Sow, on the personal, ecological, and cultural significance of seeds. Jennifer's greatest passion is elevating the way we think and talk about gardening, the empowerment of gardeners, and the possibility inherent in the intersection between places, environments, cultures, individuals, and the gardens that bring them together beautifully for the better of all the lives on this generous planet. Welcome to the show today, Jennifer. Are you ready to rock seeds?
You bet I am. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you for being here. And I shared a bit about you. Can you fill in the blanks for us and share more about the path you took to get where you're at today?
I think one of the crucial pieces of information about me was that I was the very lucky daughter of a professional gardening mother and a wildlife biologist father. So you can see the kind of marriage of those two people's passions in almost everything I do. I love that interface between what our gardens are in this world and how they interact with and impact, but also are in conversation with the wild world around them and in them in many cases. I was raised at about 8,000 feet in Colorado. And the reason I give you that information is that is some tough gardening. People out there who have any familiarity with gardening at elevation know what I'm talking about. And so my mom was really hardcore and joyful and creative and just loved everything about the garden, from fruits and vegetables to a whole lot of flowers. And my father remains passionate about everything to do with wildlife biology, whether it's taking surveys in streams to see what the fish are eating and therefore what the health of that stream life is founded on, to being able to identify waterfowl on the wing from many hundreds of feet away from him, from sound, from the way they held their wings. So these people's interests really informed so many of mine. And when I grew up and went off to school, I got my degree in literature and writing, but ultimately also on the side of life became a very avid gardener myself. And the way these things work, I started to want to write about how much I loved my garden, how much I was learning in my garden as a young 20-something. And that led me to my first couple of paid pieces as a garden writer. And after about 10 years of that, a 10-year period in which myself and my former husband and our first daughter were living in Seattle, we were then in England for my former husband's work, and then we were back in Colorado and then relocated to California. And I tell you all of that because in that 10-year period of being in a bunch of different environments and being a mother, which I think was a critical shift to the way I think about the world, I became more and more disenchanted with mainstream gardening media. Every time I give a talk in person and I say that line, you can see at least a third, if not more, of any audience start nodding. Yeah. And they know what we're talking about. And it's that somehow, some terrible confluence from maybe post-World War II on, with the increase in leisure time, the development of a very solid middle class with quote-unquote discretionary income, and then magazines about lifestyles and home whatever, and then the rise of marketing and consumerism as an actual full-time activity. Like this, all of this came together to create this whole new world for gardeners. But it was a world that looked really pretty on a two-dimensional, superficial piece of paper, whether that was a book or a magazine or a newspaper. But something about that confluence began to contract and diminish what we think of when we think of the words garden or gardener or gardening. And it really became perceived as and represented as more and more this sort of frivolous activity, a kind of dilettante hobby of the middle and upper classes, as a status symbol or an object you could pick up at a big box store and install in your backyard this weekend. And that is so not the truth and fullness of what it means to be a gardener. We know this, right? It is not an activity of the elite. It is an activity and a relationship and a calling of all peoples across all space and time on this planet. And it has always been born of us wanting to eat, us wanting to enjoy beauty, mm-hmm. us wanting to encourage and partake of ritual and ceremony, us wanting to heal ourselves and our communities. And so this, again, is a long story of my path, but it's—
No, you're doing great. There's so much there.
There is, and I don't think we can ever have enough people pushing against that two-dimensionality and that derivative of what gardening is, because when we do it well and when we appreciate and grasp its fullness, that's when we understand what I truly believe and what I think most of my readers and listeners to my podcast believe, and that is that gardeners are actually, and gardening is an incredibly important part of our cultural literacy. And that Amen. It is like, it is great literature. It is great art. It is great food. It is great music. It's one of these things that are among the best expressions of what it means to be human. And when we grasp that, we change the world for the better. That's yeah. my path. And that will continue wow. to be my path until I stop breathing.
Yeah. Boy, I hear you. Well, and as you were sharing that, I, in my mind, I was overlaying this whole notion of the social media aspect of it. And there's, I watch multiple Facebook pages, Facebook groups that propose to help people with their gardening. Mm. And I watch the responses that people get. I just shake my head. There's so much misinformation out there.
Mm-hmm. So much misinformation. And I'm in my late 50s. I've been gardening my whole life. We always, always have something more to learn, right? No two ways about it. I don't know everything there is to know about gardening. You don't. Neither does the next person, no matter what they might say to you. And so one of the things that I have really strived for is to not spend a bunch of time doing what I do on my podcast, Cultivating Place, or in most of my books. I don't spend a ton of time on the how-to. And the reason is not that I don't believe in the how-to. I do. And I know a lot of how-to. But I also firmly believe that the how-to garden is best served very fresh and very local. And so I can give you some ideas of what I'm doing and how I'm doing it here in Zone 8B, interior Northern California. But I don't really want you to listen to me unless you live about maybe 5 miles from me. I want you right? to listen to the people who are doing it well where you live. Now, yeah. your podcast is very focused on a segment of the world that needs all of the how-to they can get because yeah. they are trying to be farmers. They are trying to be farmers in urban environments. And so there's some universality there. Yeah. But I think that as gardeners and as urban farmers of whatever scale, we always will need the how-to, but we also need to keep interrogating our own whys. Not why do you do it that way because of the physics of it or the science of it, but why spiritually, mentally, and philosophically we do these things. Because unless we know that why, then our how-to is always going to fall a little short, if you ask me. Like, until you know the heart and motivation, and I know we're going to talk about the things like what drives us, but what drives me is this idea that I want gardeners to understand their power. And once they understand their power, to attach a philosophy to that allows everything they do to have a greater difference, to make a better, grow a better world.
Wow. Very well said. Thank you. One of the reasons you're here today is to talk about your book, and it sounds like you've written several. Can you tell me briefly about your other books that you've written?
Sure. I'm going to actually start with the founding of the podcast I host, which is a second iteration. So I went through this period of great disillusionment, and I was like, if I never write for another glossy magazine in my life, that will not be too soon. Now, that was back in like 2005. Our magazines, our editors, our writers, our general gardening media has made some pivot. They have made some progress, and I love to see it. But when I moved with my young family to interior Northern California, and I keep saying that because it's important. People hear the word California and they're like, oh, do you live in San Francisco? Or, oh, do you live on the beach? And no, I don't. Yeah. I live in the foothills, in the dry, hot interior at the northern end of the great Sacramento Valley. And it's a very different world. So the point here is that we moved, and I really didn't want to keep doing the writing I had been doing. And I was driving down the road, and I heard my public radio station put out a request for volunteer PSA writers. And I thought to myself, I could do that. And maybe I could suggest to them that they need a gardening program with what I had in mind. And so I walk into this tiny little public radio station, and there's this great old public radio guy, Joe O, and he had this deep public radio voice. And I said, I would be happy to be a volunteer PSA writer, but my ulterior motive is that I think you need a garden program, and I think that I am the person to do that. And Joe nice. O was right, and he was hysterical. He was like, okay, Mary Tyler Moore, let's go. Do you really? He was so funny. And he said, do you think you have enough material for a whole year? What do you think?
Oh, my gosh.
And I was like, Joe O, I have you covered for at least a year. And that was in 2007. And so in the beginning, it was very locally based, my 10 county area. But it really started digging into these ideas of as much about what our gardens look like as what they mean to us, as much about how to as why are we doing this and what does it mean in the world. And so that program grew up into Cultivating Place in 2016, and it went to an hour, and it went national, and it syndicated across the country on various stations, and as a podcast reaches as they do around the world. Yeah. And it was the launch of the podcast in the form of Cultivating Place, whose subtitle is Conversations on Natural History and the Human Impulse to Garden. And about a year after the podcast was underway, Timber Press, one of our nice horticultural presses here in the U.S. based out of Portland, reached out to me and said, would you like to write a book about women in gardening? And I said, yes, I would, as long as I am allowed to focus on this in the way that I focus on gardening. And they said, as long as it's not about dead English white women only, you can do whatever you want. And I said, first of all, dead English white women are pretty well covered at this point. And second of all, they're really hard to interview. So I think we're good. And So that led to my first book, which is called The Earth in Her Hands, 75 Extraordinary Women Working in the World of Plants. Now, the reason that I'm telling you this story is that
wow,
that was my first book. What We Sow, which is the one you and I are going to talk about most today, is my third book. But each of the books is definitely an expansion and a substantiation, if you will, of the mission of my podcast, which is what I preached about in the beginning of this conversation, the engaging, empowering, expanding, and hopefully like emboldening gardeners to really reject the idea that this act is superficial or frivolous or just so cute and pretty, and rather that it's one of the transformational acts and faiths, if you will, really, like it's an act of faith that we can make the world better through food, through habitat, through all these things, through beauty, through engaging yeah. with other people and plants. So that first book, which was interesting, I focused on these 75 women with the idea of trying to demonstrate that when people who love plants and are knowledgeable about plants, specifically women, are they reach, whether they're put there or they grow there themselves or they make it happen in their own lives, when they are in leadership decision-making positions in our mm-hmm. world, they change everything, both because of their passion and knowledge of plants, but also because of their experience in the world to there. When I was researching these women, I came up with a sort of list, a Gantt chart of all the different fields that are related to what we mean when we say gardening or horticulture. So this includes artists, writers, photographers, scientists, public policy developers, nursery people, plant breeders, like so many different levels, right? But one of those threads were people working in seeds. And I profiled five women who were doing really expansive work in the world of seed. So this included Renee Shepherd of Renee's Garden, like a great early catalog of organic, non-GMO, many open pollinated, many heirloom seeds. Rowan White, who is a rock star indigenous leadership voice, asking us to really rethink everything in the world, but through this lens of seed. And she is the founder of the Indigenous Seed Keepers Network. It included Ira Wallace of the Southern Exposure Seed Exchange and her work
with
seeds of the African diaspora. And then Carol Larise, who's the executive director of the Organic Seed Alliance. And this got me really looking at like people working in seed. And so when March 2020 hits and me, an avid gardener, think I know it all, right? I know I don't know it all, but we often think we know more than we do.
We do. Yep.
In March of 2020, our understanding of the world as we know it was handed to us on a plate and we were schooled in everything we didn't know.
Big
and
time.
One of those things for me, Greg, was the seed world. Like, all of a sudden, I was ordering seed from people and seed sellers I love, admire, support, think I understand, and kept getting those messages that we all got in March of 2020, like out of order, backstocked, whatever, unavailable. And
yeah.
I thought to myself, how is that even possible? If our seed supply is that precarious, that fragile, that easy to disrupt, that's not a good thing. Like, how does this work? And so I really thought to myself, Jennifer Jewell, big shot gardener lady, you need to know more and you need to do this research, because as a gardener, it's your responsibility to understand more about these things we rely on.
Yeah. And that is the first step of our food system.
That's the first step of everything, Greg.
Like, yes.
That's it. It is our ecosystems. It is our food system. It is our utility. It is our medicine. It is everything when you
yes.
come down to it. And ultimately, I write in the book, like, Seed is the alpha and the omega. Like we think about the Messiah, if you think about a Messiah, as the alpha and the omega, that is what seed is in our world. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, as I did this research, I just kept actually having my own mind just wide open, blown wide open by things that I just really took for granted. Like you hold an acorn in your hand and you think, oh yeah, that becomes an oak tree, like whatever. But no, think about that. That's an acorn, and it can become the 250-year-old valley oak tree that is providing shade, shelter, food, and community for hundreds of different lives over 250 years. That is a crazy scale and timeline, way beyond my ability to grasp. And it's either sits in my hand or I walk by it every day and I don't think twice about it.
Yeah.
And that right there was enough for me to just be like, I am all in on this research, no matter how hard it gets. This is important stuff. And if I didn't know it, then I figured there were a lot of gardeners out there that also didn't know it and would appreciate a primer on kind of the state of seed in our world from a gardener's perspective.
Wow. And so the book is What We Sow. Tell us about the pathway into the book and through the book.
It was hard and rigorous. And I had to, gardening is hard and rigorous and often humbling, right? But this process was unique and humbling for me. Writing a book, for anybody out there who's ever done it, it's hard work, and you want to get it right. Like, nobody does this as a throwaway effort. And seed is very personal to me. Ever since I was a child, like as I started doing this research, one of the things that became clear was how much I did know, right? So I had to go back and review my early seed experiences, what I thought I knew, why they were personally important to me, and think about being a young person and collecting acorns, playing with acorns in their caps, and they're mm-hmm. a little family, and then they're a whole community. And you think about blowing a dandelion, or you think about picking beans, or whatever it might be. They're like, they are part of our everyday life in a way that we forget to notice. And just
that is a huge statement right there.
Yeah.
They're part of our everyday life that we forget to notice.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this was an exercise for me in paying real attention every day to where I live, what was happening around me, and how that gave me an access point into some bigger issues. Having moved from 8,000 feet in Colorado to interior Northern California in my mid-30s, one of the things that was amazing to me, and this was a big leap in my own understanding of seed, was that I changed plant palettes. And when I changed plant palettes, meaning what grows in Colorado is very different than what grows in Northern California. And all of a sudden, I landed in this incredible biodiversity hotspot, which the California Floristic Province is one of the 33 internationally designated biodiversity hotspots. The most biodiverse section of the state and the floristic province is actually up in the northeast corner in the Klamath Mountain ranges. Mm-hmm. And so I'm living in this environment surrounded by all of these native plants who were sometimes familiar. You can recognize this is a pine, this is an oak, this is a maple, mm-hmm. but I didn't know all the species. So this was like that great moment when you go to a foreign country and you notice everything because everything is unfamiliar. And so that was one of my first big leaps in appreciating and observing seed diversity, was just living in Northern California. I moved here in the late summer, early fall. So seed was prevalent yep. everywhere. And in time, I became the curator of the native plant garden at a natural history museum on the campus of California State University, Chico. And for them, I developed with my partner, John, who we developed a whole exhibit on the diversity of seed of these native plants of our region.
Wow.
But of course, they have universal application no matter where you live, because as we know, maples and oaks and pines and whatever, they do have some relationship to their genus across wherever the species might exist. So that taught me a lot about seed. But what was interesting is that when I started on this book, one of the important things to me was to really dig into why this was personally important. There were multiple books that I read that were beautiful descriptions, like in-depth, thorough descriptions of seed biology or seed evolution. I'm thinking of Thor Hansen's The Triumph of Seeds is one example of a great discourse on how seed has evolved over time to really dominate our economy in the plant world, mm-hmm. to dominate our planet. But it was an academic conversation or discourse. And I kept wanting to shake Thor a little bit and be like, dude, like, where is the skin in the game here? This matters to us really personally and individually. And at the end, he attributed his wife with being the gardener. And so that was over there. Whereas the like scientific research of the history of seed evolution was over here in a different tone of voice. And I thought, these two things need to come together a little bit. And what was happening, the morphology and phenology of the seeds and plants of my area was the calendar and structure around which I then entered into research into different aspects of seed politics, seed law, seed history, seed evolution, that mm-hmm. kind of thing.
On seed politics, that's a rabbit hole in itself.
That is a big, bad rabbit hole, and it is full of some alarming things, but also I think important for us to keep an eye on if we can, as many of us as can to keep an eye on if we can. Yeah.
And so the book, What We Sow, is a calendar year of experiences for you.
Yeah.
I assuming that it started in March?
No, you are not. You are assuming it started in October. So used the autumnal equinox and this harvest moment that is late summer, early fall as the point. Because when you think about seed, it's like a circle. There isn't a real beginning and an end. And while spring is one beginning because we plant our seed, that's not really a point at which I saw seed starting. And so I started with when seeds are dispersing, when they are mature and either being harvested and saved until planting in the spring. So I started with the ripe dispersal and dormancy period. And then I go through the calendar from there back to the next October. And I try through the course of the book to also relate this to our own life cycles, because I kept feeling and seeing and hearing echoes between my own stage in life and what I saw as the life cycle of a seed or a seed-bearing plant. And I found that interesting. And I found that really echoed in our language, in our English language, how much we use seed as a metaphor for something bigger and related to us. And like you think of seeding clouds, of seed money, of seeds of change, of seeds of war, it's this word that is small. It's this thing that is small, but symbolically, it's very big in our imaginations. And I thought that was an important kind of psychology to try and plumb, because I think that if we get it, we understand ourselves better through the mm-hmm. lens of how we understand seed, but we also understand seed better and more compassionately and personally if we see ourselves and our lives reflected there also.
And your book, It's your personal experience, but you also did research, correct?
A lot of research, a lot of interviews, a lot of research. Yes.
What are one or two things that might have been jaw-dropping that you found in this process?
We hear a lot about seed consolidation, the consolidation of seed genetics and ownership and dominance in the industrial business side of seed. And the statistics are alarming in that something like 60% of all of the seed industry is owned and controlled by four large international petrochemical pharmaceutical companies. So I know I like that sounds like it rolls off my tongue really easily, but I want you to sit with that idea. Our seed, which is the basis of our food system, as you already noted, it is also the basis of our ecosystem diversity and health and survival. This is controlled by pharmaceutical petrochemical companies. That is a disturbing and unsettling fact.
Yeah.
Now that 60%, like you can mollify yourself with the idea that 60% is primarily commodity seed, corn, soy, wheat, whatever it might be. But then I want you to get back into the uncomfortable part, because the fact is soy, corn, wheat, these are some of the staple foods, rice,
yep.
Staple, sacred, cultural foods of land-based peoples and cultures that date back hundreds of thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that we can just toss them away as commodity, I think, is a discredit to the importance of that seed. And it is a disassociation from the history and legacy of those groups, enormous diversity that our commodification has reduced down to so few. So what I mean by that is when you think about the huge diversity of corn variations that have been selected and stewarded and cared for and passed forward by the peoples of North America over these last thousands and thousands of years, and that we've reduced it down to three or four primary selections of dent number four corn that is now doused in chemicals and planted out on hundreds of millions of acres across the middle of America. That is an alarming destruction of this gift, this treasure that was stewarded and passed to us. It's a disgrace.
We talk about that a lot in our seed chats,
yeah,
in our seed school, and we address that in a lot of ways because there's something we can do about it.
There's so much we can do about it. And I think while the average home gardener might not be growing a whole lot of corn and they might not be interested in becoming an urban farmer and joining a seed school, just to know this fact allows them to spend their seed dollars differently, to vote about things like the farm bill differently, to just pay attention a little bit differently so that we aren't complicit in a structural truth that we don't believe in and don't want to support.
Wow. Okay. That was one thing you found. Was there another one?
Oh, yeah. The other one, I'll go ahead because there are just so many, but I would share about the catastrophe that is chemical warfare in our food system and our lands, but I'm not going to because I already just preached at you about the,
That's okay.
Commodification. I'd rather give you a happy jaw drop. And that is that in remembering that there are, for those listeners, many, your listeners are pretty well versed on all of these things. But just to remind ourselves as gardeners and humans that the seed-bearing flowering plants, the angiosperms, those plants which make up the lion's share of the plants we love and grow, eat from, and propagate in this world. And I look out my window and I see a pear and I see a grass and I see a camellia, and I see my native sage, and I see my holiday garland of cedar. And these are all seed-bearing plants, the gymnosperms and the angiosperms. But the angiosperms specifically, they were so wildly successful once they showed up about 365 million years ago. They now constitute about 300,000 different species that represent 80% of all plant life on the planet. These guys are so cool, and they have been so successful because they have figured out how to adapt, evolve, spread their seed, and survive. They know stuff that we don't know about fire, about heat, about drought, about ice, about dormancy, and just waiting out a bad situation. This reminds me that my tiny life will end, and I will have spent a lot of hot air talking to gardeners, but the seeds are going to survive. Like, we've messed up a lot, but the seeds are still there. And the incredible number of seed-keeping humans on the ground everywhere, they are doing great work. And so have faith that there is still plenty we can do to grow the world better with seeds and the seed keepers among us.
Nice. So just as a side note, an angiosperm is the flowering plant.
Perfect. The gymnosperms, just so we like make sure we're clear about this, the seed-bearing plants are the spermatophytes. They include both the gymnosperms, which are our cone-bearing plants, like our conifers, and the angiosperms, which are our flowering seed-bearing plants. So the angiosperms came after the gymnosperms in evolutionary timeline.
That makes sense.
But because of their flowers and their harnessing their attractiveness and their needs with the skills of the flying, pollinating insects and animals, that is where the big uptick in success. And our planet is now beautifully clothed with this great diversity of flowering, seed-bearing plants. They feed us, they clothe us, they house us, they create the air we breathe.
Yeah. So you clearly love seeds and plants. Do you have any favorite seeds or seed plants?
Oh, gosh, that's such a hard question. But yes, I do. I am a huge fan of the acorn. I think one of the reasons, I'm sure there's some lizard brain connection there, is that oaks are so diversified and prevalent no matter where humans have lived. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that on a counter behind me, I have acorns and acorn caps from a recent visit to Maine, and another one to Ohio, and another one to Vermont, and another one to Colorado, and another one to Tucson, and all across the West Coast. You will always meet this family, this genus, and it will always feel like you are seeing an old friend. And they are just so iconic and relatable, right? You want to pick them up and you want to put them in your pocket and take them home.
Yeah, I completely get that. So your book, What We Sow, what is your greatest hope for it being in the world?
I think it is the hope of a seed. It is the hope that it will grow a different understanding. It will grow a different awareness. I think this comes back in some way to my complaints about the mainstream garden media that was true in the early 2000s and from the early 1990s until then. Mm-hmm. And that is that gardeners were often spoken to as though we were somehow not that bright, like very pretty, but not that bright.
Yeah.
And I don't believe that. I believe that most gardeners I know are deeply curious, very creative, and very intelligent. So they can take a long sentence with multiple clauses and a complex thread of a thought across many pages. And so my hope is that this long book without any pictures engages with enough gardeners that we see an uptick in appreciation and observation and then action on behalf of seed and seed integrity in the world. That's what I hope.
Wow. Beautiful. What We Sow by Jennifer Jewell, published by Timber Press. And I'm sure we can find it just about anywhere you buy books, right?
Anywhere you buy books.
Excellent. So I'm going to shift on you, and I'd like for you to talk about a time you failed, how you overcame that failure, and what you might have learned from it.
There are so many times we fail as gardeners, right? To just pick one to humiliate myself with. I would say that the one of the most transformational for me was that move from Colorado to California. I really thought that I was in a Western state, that I knew that what there was to know, that it was going to be hot and dry in the summer, and it was going to be cooler and more moisture in the winter, and that the plants I would grow in my garden would be the same. And oh my Lord, was I wrong. I was so wrong, and I killed so many plants. The second thing that happened was that upon arrival to California, we took several forays over to the coast and we visited great nurseries. I went to the Bay Area and I went to Annie's and I went to Flora Grub and all these great nursery places. And I bought a bunch of plants and I brought them back home and I killed them.
Yeah.
And the fact is, they are very different places. And I had a lot to learn about just listening, looking, paying attention to the new climate I was in, not presuming I understood it all, and that I had to plant at a very different time, that I had to create drainage that I didn't know that I had to create. It was a great reminder to shut up and listen first.
Yeah.
Plant and design your garden after.
Yeah.
And I learned a lot. I'm a much better gardener.
Yeah, my friend Zach Brooks from Arizona Worm Farm.
Yes.
He reminded me, because you may not know, I moved from Phoenix to Asheville after living in Phoenix for 54 years. And he reminded me when I was lamenting to him how miserable my first year garden was here. He reminded me something that I wouldn't have known, because I hadn't had a first garden in 47 years.
Right.
He said, "Greg, remember, your first garden is your worst garden." Oh, okay. I get that.
Yeah. Yeah. And at least you probably did not suffer the delusion that you were moving from a like climate to a like climate. You were clear that Phoenix was going to be very different than Asheville. But I just blithely went about as though I was still gardening in Colorado, and California taught me differently.
Yeah, there you go. And what do you consider your biggest success?
My two daughters. I would definitely say those are my greatest success, because they are nice, bright, active humans in the world. My second greatest success is that I still love gardening every single day. And I really believe that the joy and the inspiration and the clear head that we are gifted from time in our gardens is our greatest tool to leverage out in the world to help other people love gardening, come to gardening, know gardening, and at least support gardeners. That it's not the shaking your head or wagging your finger saying, "Don't do it that way, do it this way." There are always as many different ways to garden, as many different beautiful gardens as there are different gardeners. But the one universal I find is that joy. And when we start from a place of the joy, we just can't go that far wrong. That mindset is my greatest success.
Nice. Well, and in our team here at the Urban Farm, our number one rule is, because we do a fruit tree program, is be safe. Our number two is have fun.
Yes.
We're not having fun. Why do it?
Why do it?
Yeah.
And if it wasn't fun and rewarding, people wouldn't have been great gardeners and plant selectors, all these generations of humans on the planet.
Yeah, exactly. And what drives you? What's your big why in the world?
I think it is wanting to elevate the way we think and talk about gardening. And I think this was to some extent probably born of a dismissal by the wider culture or shame by people that thought that, I don't know, business banking or surgery or, I don't know, being a lawyer was somehow a more successful and honorable career than being a gardener. And I want to see every professional out there be paid better. I want to see gardener out there building soil and habitat and water quality and air quality. I want the world of gardening, both pleasure gardening, personal gardening, and professional gardening, to all be meeting the crises of our times, because I believe we actually can make a lot of headway.
Oh, yeah. And I've said for years, the most important thing we can be doing right now is figuring out where our food comes from and growing our own.
Yeah.
And that's why I do what I do, is to inspire people to get out there and grow food and value that. Because when you think about what it takes to grow a head of broccoli, how many heads of broccoli that Heidi and I go through a year, it's mind-blowing.
It really is. And so to have these be underpaid, undervalued positions in our world, when in fact they are what bring cultures together, they are what drive an economy, a healthy circular economy, and they are what feed us as people. There isn't a better job out there. Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. And we need to be, as a person who pays for food and frequently pays for help in my garden when it's a task that's too big for me.
Yep.
It's me that has to say, no, you are not charging enough. I am going to pay you more. And you need more training, because you will have better skills if you have better training. Let's do this. If I don't value it, then they don't stand a chance. But if I value it and I keep impressing that on other people, we start to see the needle move.
Nice. Yeah, beautiful. And if you could recommend one book for our listeners, what would it be and why?
Again, there's a long list there, but I'm going to settle with Robin Wall Kimmerer's Braiding Sweetgrass. I think it should be required reading in every school, probably both in 6th grade maybe, and again in your final year of high school, and then maybe even again in order to exit college. You'll get something different from it each time.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Cool. And if you could offer one piece of advice for our listeners, what would it be?
Oh, you already know this advice. It's be safe and have fun. I mean, grow what you love and keep having fun, because that is how we keep growing.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show today, Jennifer.
Thank you so much for having me. It has been a great joy, and I can't wait to come and see your garden in Asheville, North Carolina sometime.
I'm here, and it'll be open for tours in 2024. Oops, did I say that?
You are now committed.
Yeah, my urban farm in Phoenix, we did tours of that for over 20 years. So for me, that's a way to get people engaged and seeing things that, I could do that.
Yeah. Wow, that's great.
So how can our listeners get a hold of you?
Let's see. On my website, cultivatingplace.com, or the only social media I can really actively engage in, I've picked one. It's Instagram. It auto feeds over to Facebook, but you are more likely to get a comment back from me or a conversation going with me on Instagram.
That's
where
right.
I am cultivating_place.
Perfect. And your website?
Cultivatingplace.com.
.com. Very good. And you can also find show notes from today's podcast at urbanfarm.org/what we sow.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Urban Farm Podcast. Remember to listen for tips, advice, and resources to help you on your journey with urban farming. You can find us on the web at urbanfarm.org, or send us an email to podcast@urbanfarm.org. In the words of Vincent van Gogh, great things are done by a series of small things brought together. Be encouraged that with each lesson learned and skill developed, you are one step closer in the direction of your dreams.